Yes. Welcome, real guys, real sports guys, where real guys talk real sports, RSG Renegade Radio. I got the crew in the house. Three-man booth is in full effect. I got my man D. Wills holding us down. Holler at the people.
I don't know if my boy Bart Scott going to be saying, can't wait, after that beatdown that they took. It looked like just abuse. It looked like bullying. And I'm looking forward to talking about the state of the Jets.
We're gonna get into that tonight. We got a jam packed show. Before we get into the rundown of everything we got going on, I want my man Phil T Sports PhD to check in real quick.
What's happening, fellas? What's happening, world? I want to take 5 seconds just to say, let's get off of Steve Bartman's behind. Saw the special 30 for 30 about Steve Bartman. And this guy's had a rough time, man. He's had a rough time. So just a very random statement, but my heart was moved. My heart was moved to say a kind word for Steve Bartman.
Not random at all, man. And I think we could touch on that. We could take it that way as we get into the funky editorial. For all the listeners out there, I'm always quarterbacking a set. Marcus, you man, the game changer, holding it down for the next 2 hours. All right? If you want to get on at any time, feel free to call in at 1-347-989-0844. We're going to keep it moving. We're going to keep it rolling. And we're just going to jump right in like we always do about this time with the funky editorial.
For the one thing we need to say, shall we say it, y'all? Melvin,
right.
Jimmy,
right.
Coleman, Ryan, sit. Yeah. Everybody want to get funky one more time.
All right, so the funky editorial, this is our opportunity to give the unique spin that you get only from the real sports guys. We're going to give that spin. We're going to take a topic, get into it, dig into it, you know, get our shovels out and really lay it down. So this week, you know, I grew up on the south side of Chicago. My man D. Wills and PhD are Michigan guys. And every state, every major city, every good sports town, they have their sacred cows. Athletes, public figures, people that if you say something bad about this person, you might want to put your dukes up because you might have a fight on your hands. Now, again, being from the south side of Chicago, being a Chicago kid to the heart, say something bad about Walter Payton, and I got some words for you, okay? Because Sweetness was that dude, and you didn't say anything bad about Walter, because Walter never meant no harm to nobody. So now you got this book coming out, and they're slandering my man. They're talking about him using drugs, weird behavior. You know, we all knew Walter was a different cat, okay? That's nothing new. That's nothing new to people who listen to sports radio in Chicago because they talk about it all the time, about different things, little quirks here and there, different things that Walter would do with certain reporters that, you know, he just had little jokes and things. He was a jovial cat. So that's nothing new. They ain't talking about drug use and that kind of stuff. And the question I want to raise to you guys, are we at a point in our social history as a society where there can no longer be sports heroes? And I don't want to essentialize it as if that's something that is necessary or something that has to be, but it is something that has been. And I'm sure that there's people in the camp out there that believe that's a good thing, that we don't look to athletes anymore as heroes, quote-unquote, or role models. And I'm down for that conversation too. But I think I would appreciate that more if it were driven by a desire to honor regular folks as opposed to propping up guys because they can run fast or they can, you know, shoot a ball into a cylinder from 30 feet out or whatever. I believe that where we're at now is more predicated on the kind of media atmosphere, climate, culture that we live in. So I'm going to throw that to you guys and let you guys kind of pontificate That's a new word. Get my Oswald. What was the cat in the Living Color who was in jail and always used the big words wrong? Y'all know who I'm talking about? Well, I'm out there on my own on that one.
I don't, but you dropped it in jovial very nice a few minutes.
Hey, you know, I'm trying. I do it for the community. I do it for the people. So I'm going to let you fellas pontificate on that one for a moment. I'm going to pass this one. Who wants to? I'm going to let you guys pick who wants to. I'm going to let you guys get in the huddle and yell at me for a moment. Who wants to route? Who wants to out?
I'll take the ball. Like Keyshawn said, I'll take the ball.
All right, you got this one.
So, I mean, RJ Page was on last week, our baseball guy. He came on, and Eric Hamilton was on the week before, and I think they touched on this. Like, we grew up in Kalamazoo, which is... It is 2 hours. It's right in the middle of Chicago and Detroit, 2 hours both ways. And so we were blessed that, you know, we typically got the Lions or the Bears on TV. So like you mentioned, Marcus, you grew up with, you know, in Chicago, so naturally you follow the Bears. Well, even 2 hours away, the Bears are my team too because, well, obviously the Lions weren't very good. Just like they've been throughout our lifetime. So a lot of us gravitated towards the Bears, especially in the mid-'80s when they won the Super Bowl and a few years after that where they were just really dominant. So I, like you, it was really tough to hear stuff about Walter Payton. And, for example, Tiger Woods, I really didn't enjoy hearing about his personal life, but it wasn't as personal. It wasn't as close to me, okay? But with Walter Payton, I mean, this is a dude that, when I think about my first or second book in grade school, it was a book about Walter Payton, you know, where he grew up at. He went to a small school down south, Jacksonville, or Jacksonville State, wherever it was at, you know, and he turns into this top-notch running back. It was just really tough for me to hear all these negative things about him. And like you mentioned, Marcus, he always been a little bit of a quirky cat, you know. I mean, you see this big dude, he opened up his mouth. It's kind of like Carl Lewis. They open up their mouths, and you're not really expecting that, okay? But you think about it, there's an award named after this guy in the NFL. What is it, the Citizenship Award or something like that? I just have a hard time with them coming out with all these negative things about his life where he's not able to defend them. And that's my biggest issue with the topic.
Well said, well said. Now, I'm going to run the go route to my man D. Wills and let him continue that thread, that idea that CLT just put on the table. As far as, you know, you're going after a guy who is no longer able to explain his behavior, explain himself, and so you have these events, secondhand accounts of things that went on, and you don't get that other side in that perspective. So I'm gonna run the go route to D. Wills real quick and let him take it where it needs to go.
Yeah, I mean, this is just really complex. I think, you know, much like all three of us, there were people as we grew up, and it didn't really matter who you were a fan of. There's certain athletes that just epitomize what it meant to be great. Like, they're always the litmus test. And in football, it's like it's Jim Brown, and then next you know, it's like Walter Payton. I mean, there are certain people, you know, it doesn't matter what city you rooted for or whatever, when you say their names, it means something, right? You know what it means, and it's more than just football. And I think, you know, the hard part about this is that when Walter played, it was kind of near the end of what I would call the sacred era for the modern athlete, in a sense where they had the athletic and public persona, and they had the private life. Because you didn't have all the things that come now with social media. It's more than 24-hour news. It's not even 24-hour news. It's 24 hours times 10. Even though those are number of hours a day, the way in which information moves today is much harder. I mean, you can be at dinner with someone and they can tweet, and millions of people can know what you're doing right now because someone saw you and sent something through Twitter. And so it's kind of like this book and this topic and this time is like a clash of two different times in terms of the rules of engagement. Like we grew up in it, and there were certain things, and this gets back to our point, that we knew about some of our childhood heroes, but we didn't want to know. What we really wanted to know about them is what we saw, what we gravitated towards, and we whatever happened in that other part was what happens in the other part. It's like we didn't even think about life outside the field when we were looking at our athletes in a way that we do now. And so to unpack someone like this who, again, like we said, is not here to defend himself, you know, with a widow and with kids who have to answer questions, you have to ask, what's the purpose? Like, what's the reason for writing a book like this at this time? There's so many other topics, so many more relevant athletes. Even if you think about the Chicago market, there's many more athletes you could probably write about even now and draw something for if you had a book to do. You know, it's like, why? What's the purpose of this? And what every author should have a reason or a story to tell in terms of their purpose for doing something like this. And right now I'm having a hard time understanding why this is relevant now. And I think that's what's hard is for people who love Walter from afar and respected the whole idea of what sweetness meant. He was played in the 70s. Popping painkillers, that's what everybody did. You know, it ain't like, it's not like if you talk about the Steelers and the rumors of steroids and all that stuff was going on at that time in terms of people just, if you hear Mike Golick talk about what they did to stay on the field, it's just the way they thought. You didn't have agents all the time telling you that you had to protect yourself as an asset. So, you know, you have, like a lot of the guys we have on IR, you know, some of these guys even, you know, I think that's why I say it was the last kind of transition point of what we do as that kind of modern gladiator before it went ultimate business. And Walter, the irony of it, Walter played for a team that helped push that transition to 85 Bears in terms of creating that kind of persona that kind of just blasted everybody into a different way of looking at kind of modern football. So, you know, that's kind of how I, you know, just to kick it off. I know we got more we could talk about with it, but it's just something that's just hard to digest. And I think every author, you know, whether we should have public discourse, and I'm real big on that because I don't think we do that enough in America. I think we forgot that the what it is to be an American is about civil discourse, public discourse, talking about it in a civil way. But I'm still trying to figure out what the point is. And I think most people who care about Walter still haven't been able to answer questions. So what are we trying to learn from this? Why now? Why is this an important conversation to have now? That's the part that I think, other than sensationalism, what's the point?
And that's the jump off for me, is that I've said it before. I think you guys agree with this sentiment, is that if our heroes, you know, when I emailed out the rundown of the show today, guys, I put out there as people who we kind of hold up as these sacred cows in different communities that you just don't go after, you know, in Kentucky, Louisville, Ali, you can't touch Muhammad, you can't touch Cassius, you can't say nothing bad about him, you know, Boston, it's Bill Russell. You know, Russell is that guy. It's a Larry Bird. It's a McHale. Those kind of guys. In L.A., you got your Magics and your Worthies and guys like that who you really can't go in on. And, of course, you know, in pretty much the Midwest and a lot of places, Jordan, you can't really say too much bad about Jordan. In hockey, you got Gretzky. You got Unitas, guys like that. Baseball is Babe Ruth, Willie Mays, Hank Aaron, guys like that. Those are people that we look at as sacred cows, as the epitome of what it means to be a great athlete and a great person. We would not view those guys the same way if they had to play in this media climate. Plain and simple. We wouldn't view them the same. We wouldn't, you know, our ignorance allowed us to revere in the success of these players and possibly project things upon these players that maybe necessarily weren't really them, weren't rooted in their performance in their particular sport, but they gave us enough to dream a little bit. They gave us enough to invest a little bit of ourselves in their success. And nowadays it's hard to do that. It really is. I remember when the Heat lost in that game six, and, you know, I had a little frenzy on Facebook because I went nuts. The jokes was coming. I just had jokes and jokes and jokes and jokes. So I had a lot of, I had a lot to say when the Heat lost. It wasn't necessarily negative towards the Heat. It was more just the way they lost was entertaining to me. But even in that, one of my younger siblings posted, and he asked, how can people morally root against, how can they balance the morals of rooting against a LeBron James while at the same time rooting for a team that has a convicted domestic violence offender and Jason Kidd on it? And so that ruffled a lot of feathers, so people start going back and forth. And I'm still in jokey joke mode. I'm still jokey smirk right now. So I'm still telling jokes throughout the whole little post and the whole little thread. And one thing I did say was that, you know, if you're going to root based upon, if you're going to invest in sports and call yourself a fan and carry this moral attachment to your team or attachment to, every team has a couple cats with a couple felonies. Every team's got a couple cats who may still be on paper. Every team has a couple of those guys, except maybe the San Antonio Spurs. They have team Bible study and stuff like that. But in all seriousness, nowadays, I, for one, expect that these guys are imperfect. I expect that. And I understand that. And that's what I almost enjoy about watching these guys, is that their personality, nowadays you can understand how a personality flaw can affect someone's ability to be the greatest or just good. You know, I always tell people all the time, there's a reason why Corey Maggette is Corey Maggette and LeBron is LeBron. Both of them are physical specimens. Both of them are extremely physically gifted. But there's something about Corey Maggette's mental makeup that doesn't allow him to take his physical, that didn't allow him to take his physical gifts to the level that LeBron's physical gifts have allowed him to excel. And with today's, you know, we may want to even go as far as to say the 25 hours a day, 8 days a week news cycle, we get to see those flaws more. And in doing that, it lets us in. But then at the same time, we don't get to dream. We don't get to impose our dreams upon. These guys aren't blank slates for us to kind of impose our own definitions and images upon. We know everything that they do. I mean, if LeBron sneezes, you know, on somebody in the airport, if somebody's tweeting it, LeBron just sneezed on me. How rude, you know? And we know. And it's out there, and that goes as news. And so the question I'm putting out there, and that this Walter Payton thing, again, kind of got me to think about again, and Walter Payton isn't the only example. You got Tiger Woods, you know. You got a guy like LeBron James. You got a guy like Michael Vick. All of these guys have a heightened sense of attention around them, a very hyper-sensitive, hyper-vigilant media presence around them. Michael Vick can't throw a birthday party without the media reporting it, as if that's news, as if somebody wants to know. But then somebody does, because that's informing how we either view him or reaffirming how we already view him. So The question I'm trying to pose, yeah, make a long story short, why don't I just wrap this up? The question I'm trying to pose is there a place for athletic heroes nowadays? And I put heroes in quotes. But those, will there be any more sacred cows from here on out? Or is everybody going to the slaughtering factory from here on out?
Well, I think it's funny. We were having a discussion today looking at student-athletes and looking at transition programs for student-athletes as they come on the campus and try to work on this project. And one of the things that we talked about is this idea, one of my colleagues talked about this idea of the self-concept and, you know, what does that mean in terms of helping athletes think beyond everything. So part of this is a question, part of this is a society question, part of this is a question of athletes. You know, and in the middle of that is this multimedia lens. But the sacred cow today has more to do with how you choose to live your life. You know, are you the Tim Duncan? And I'm not saying, you know, we don't know everything about Tim, but in this world, Tim Duncan appears to be holding up. Are you the David Robinson? And so, you know, it's not going to be the world of the 1940s and 50s where, you know, reporters in the back room with, you know, Mickey Mantle and some of these guys drinking beer and watching them going crazy and, you know, they all woke up with hangovers to go to the ballpark. That's not going to be the world that we live in. And so I think there's still sacred cows today. I mean, there's still, but what athletes have learned today, they understand what they're about. And some of them, the way in which they've done it, has just been very authentic and very open. And some have chosen, like Jeter, not to get married and to not let that be part of it because part of the brand is if I were engaged in activities, I'm single. There's nothing to say. I'm just a young single guy doing what I do. And so I think Jeter is our modern-day sacred cow, in some ways, and he's done it in New York City. So that, you know, in some ways he's a sacred cow because he's done it in the media market as well. So I think it's just athletes have to calibrate, and I think a lot of them are growing up and understanding the world, and some of them are part of it. And young people live in a more authentic way. So, you know, these folks are learning to talk about things openly. And so I think there's going to be room for it. But I think what's going to happen is these athletes will control more the message and more the rollout because they know that's part of their experience. So I think it's just going to come from a different angle. But it doesn't mean that some of our heroes won't get unpacked because it's just a way to have access to information. So Walter is the last one. They'll be looking at other people who were in the 70s, 80s heroes that they'll write about. Because that's how it's going to go.
What I will say is Wilt would have got killed.
Yeah.
Wilt wouldn't have made it. Wilt wouldn't have put up those numbers. Yeah. He was running around the day because chicks would have got him quick.
Yeah. But that's Shaq. And Shaq went through a very public thing, but Shaq knows how to spin it. He's grown up in this age. So in some ways, it hasn't stuck on him so hard. People haven't gotten other than basketball wise, but Shaq's image hasn't really taken a hit in that big way. And so because he learned how to spin off.
This is the thing that bothers me about the Walter Payton situation, is that you would think that Walter Payton's actions would have been grandfathered out.
I'm going to let you say this.
He said grandfathered out.
Yes. Grandfathered out. Because, you know, like you all both touched on, this was during a time where there was this, you know, kind of like more of an unwritten law. Like you said, Devon, it was kind of like the end of the age, but it was still during that age where sports reporters, there was like part of their ethics were to leave off-the-field behavior off the field unless it was something that was blatantly in the news. And even then, there were kind of some limits. So now we've got Walter, 20, 30 years later, being held to the standards of what the modern-day athlete
works with. And most modern-day athletes, they know better and let a lot of this stuff get out there. You know, Mark McGwire, he knew better than leaving Andro in his locker. Nobody's going to do that now. They know better in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Marcus, you brought the point that, or maybe Devon did, that athletes are, you know, more authentic. I actually disagree with that. I think that because of the way they're being monitored and all the different outlets they have, I think in this next generation we're going to see athletes we're going to be able to reach out and touch them more through controlled methods like Twitter, Facebook, those kind of things. But I think gone are the days that we rub shoulders with athletes in public, big names. You know, I lived in Cleveland for 7 years in 2000 and 2007, and LeBron's first year in the league was, what, 03, 04, something like that. You know, if I was out in the club once or twice a month, I would always see LeBron down there. I would see LeBron probably half the times I went out. And he didn't have a ton of security around him. He was just at the bar hanging out with three or four of his friends. You know, I don't think you're going to see that now with an athlete like LeBron, because there's so much stuff that can go wrong. And then if something happens, all of a sudden it's, well, why is LeBron putting himself in that situation? You know, Michael Vick had a party at a club and somebody else got into a fight. And now Michael Vick's got to get escorted out the back door because if people see him there, it's like, well, why is Michael Vick even having a good time? And so, you know, I think it works both ways. And unfortunately, the way I look at it is athletes are going to be more accessible but less accessible at the same time, where they're going to be in environments that are controlled, but just kind of seeing them out and about like we were so used to seeing a lot of our athletes, I think those days are gone because the risk is just way too high.
And what I mean more about authentic, I think they're gonna have those controls in place. But you're not going to wonder as much about who they are. And you'll know that whether it's through their Twitter, whether it's through the way in which they branded out that some things are not going to be a surprise because you got TMZ, now they're into the sports world. There's no way you can – eventually it's going to come out. And there'll be a few athletes who are going to get caught because they're just not going to think about it. But most of these athletes are just pretty authentic about it. They're going to make choices about relationships, whether or not they're going to get in them earlier. They're going to have people around them just like, hey, you know, Wade 2 is through. You know, Jeter might be the model. You know, if you want to, you know, that be very clear that, you know, maybe it's after your career is over, you'll get married. You know, there'll be certain things, but the things that they'll just kind of do. But I agree, they'll control the space in which they are. And don't be surprised if you see, I mean, athletes got to, part of the brand is being public but not accessible. So being out in that space, like you said, but having those more private VIP spaces, creating their own environments, creating their own space, they're gonna create that where it's going to be invitation-only type stuff, maybe with their fans. I mean, they'll get more creative about creating their social space. And I think that's the next wave of what these athletes would do. But I think what's hurt here and what's been eroding, which we haven't really gotten to, is the relationship between the media and the athlete, which was much more cordial. And I think the only one of the media outlets that's been able to maintain that is ESPN. Some of those folks have been able to maintain some of those relationships with some of the athletes. You know, you hear Mike Greenberg and them talk a little bit more about some of the relationships they built with some of these athletes at some of the events and ongoing kinds of things. But I think athletes are going to be a little bit less, they'll be more hands-off even with how they develop relationships with folks in the media, which is, I think we lose out because of that. And those are things historically where some really good relationships were built, where there were some rules, there were some all that stuff. That stuff is totally eroded. And you know, if I'm someone in the media who wanted to maintain that, it's going to be very hard to get close to some of these athletes if you're someone who represents any kind of media outlet.
In the same sense, though, I don't see, I don't like, I like Mike and Mike, but I don't see them I don't go to them for provocative sports news. You know, I know they're going to coddle their guests. They're going to like everybody that they interview. And sometimes I don't want to hear that. Sometimes I do, and I find it more credible when reporters do go in and ask tough questions and ask hard questions, because I feel like they're doing their job as a journalist. But I also think that a lot of reporters don't want to do that because they're afraid. It's like Tiger Woods. Everybody was scared to really report on that night. Everybody was really afraid to speculate on that night when that SUV backed up into that fire hydrant. Nobody really wanted to go there. I know, and you know, y'all all married, and I'm sure that night that happened, y'all was somewhere with y'all spouse, like, it's more than a story. then it's coming out. Because that just doesn't happen that way. The situation just doesn't go down in that manner. But none of the sports outlets, none of the major sports outlets, and right now it's pretty much ESPN as far as the network goes.
Yeah,
really reported on that because they didn't want to burn that bridge with Tiger. Go ahead.
But I think that there's – oh, go ahead. I was going to say there's still – but there's still specific reporters like King and some of these other folks who have still developed relationships. You know, some of the SI folks who have been able to develop relationships with athletes and have been able to maintain that and been viewed as being fair, it's going to be even eroding some of that. So I think that's been totally eroding because I think it's the reporters who've been able to bring us in, good reporters have been able to allow us to have an inside look into the world in a real way. It's the kind of folks who unpack the Balco stories. It's the kind of folks who unpack some of this stuff. And I'm hoping that it doesn't erode, just not even the access, but how people view the motives of the reporters. Because we've lost people who are viewed as reporters who are objective, who aren't a part of the system. So I should have said that much, but I shouldn't even use Mike and Mike as an example. But we've lost reporters who can be viewed as not being part of the system, who can be objective. When we grew up, we had reporters who really reported. You know, and we don't have as much of that anymore.
You know, the one sport, in my opinion, that still has a pretty good grip on that is baseball. And, you know, baseball gets a lot of things wrong. And I hate to say it because I love the game. I grew up on the game. But there's a lot of standards and rules and unwritten rules that they won't let go. And unfortunately, I think that's one of the reasons that they're not growing. But it works both ways. And I think one of the good ways it works is a lot of these unwritten rules, you know, you throw a ball too high to me, guess what? My pitcher is going to come after you the next inning. And the umpire is not going to kick anybody out. He's going to warn them. And then at that point, when they're warned, everybody just gets back to pitching regularly. You know, in baseball, there's these unwritten rules. And I think in general, there's still unwritten rules in terms of what's reported and what's not reported versus what happens in other sports. I mean, think about it. Steroids. Less than a decade ago, steroids was still something that was swept underneath the rugs by reporters. Well, now it's okay to talk about it, but kind of like what Marcus said about Tiger Woods, you know, when that first came out, sports writers didn't want to talk about steroids. They didn't want to talk about it. And, I mean, you look at guys like Buster Olney, Timmy Kirchen. I mean, these cats never played, okay? They have developed relationships with these managers. I mean, they are lifers. I mean, you look at Melrose for hockey. He gets on everybody, okay? I think some of these sports, because they're so publicized, sports writers, they can't talk about these guys. They can't. But in sports like baseball, it's okay. And I think that's one of the things in baseball, how do I say this? They have that personal relationship, but there's still an unwritten rule that you don't talk about certain things. But it's still okay to talk about players. I mean, think about managers. Managers in baseball have a lot more leeway to talk about their players through the press than in football or basketball. If Phil Jackson says that Kobe Bryant is anything less than the best thing since sliced bread, Kobe's going to have an issue with it. And everybody in the press is going to write about it. But guess what? A baseball player has a bad day, their manager can go in the press and pretty much say, listen, he didn't get it done. And he hasn't been getting it done for the last month, and I'm going to sit him down for a few days. And that's much, much, much more accepted than when we look at basketball and football.
Well said.
So that's a good point. I think certain sports have a different relationship in the media with the media than other sports. You cited baseball as having a different kind of relationship with the media. What percentage of that has to do with race? Because I think race plays a role in who gets talked about in a certain kind of way.
Yeah.
For example, there are things that Wes Welker can say that Chad Ochocinco can't say. There are things that, you know, certain, even within race, you know,
yeah,
certain guys, Andre Johnson can do something that Terrell Owens could never do, you know. And so there's certain guys who kind of get pigeonholed by the media as bad guys, and they take a lot of liberty at spinning stories around these guys in a certain kind of way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point because, you know, right now the biggest, like the largest minority in baseball is Latino, Latin American ball players. And honestly, because they're not entrenched in our culture, as much as, say, if they were in their own countries, we don't care as much. You know, if Mariano Rivera or Cabrera gets in trouble, that's a one-day story. Cabrera has these alcohol issues. It's a one-day story. But let's say somebody who just won an MVP in basketball, whether it's LeBron or, you know, D-Wade or somebody like that, we're much, much more invested in them because I think we can, in general, we can relate with them better. I'm not saying it's right, but it's the truth. So, yeah, I think one of the things about baseball is, okay, 40% of your players in general, most of the people reading the stories don't really care about what they're doing in their personal life. That might explain why these unwritten rules still happen.
All right. Good assessment. Because I think, as with everything in this country, race is lying underneath. I always say I think a lot of people, not everybody, but I think a lot of people don't like the NBA because they don't like young, rich, and black more than it is about what's actually going on the court. And I think, you know, college athletics, I think, is still one of those places where you still have that sports hero because the media does coddle college athletes. They don't go in on college athletes the way that they do professionals, which is appropriate, I think. It's appropriate. Because, I mean, right now you could walk around Madison and Russell, you would think Russell Wilson was the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. But then he also does a good job of, he also carries himself in a certain way that people can relate to, people feel good about. So I think college athletics is still one of those places, but I agree. I think certain sports and certain cultures around certain sports but create an atmosphere that's more palpable to negative media, so to speak. The NFL has certain players. The NBA has certain guys who, if they do whatever it is that they do, Ron Artest was in that category for a couple of years. You know, he kind of moved out of that and he went from dangerous crazy from the media's perspective to funny crazy. It's just quirky crazy in the media's perspective. And that was okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would, and you know me, I'm always uplifting the context of race in the conversation. But I would argue this issue about Walter Payton This is, I think, pretty much a Chicago reporter. And I love the line Kevin Butler was, what did Kevin Butler say at the end of the article? You know, basically what we've been saying, you know, Kevin Butler was like, I was reading his article online, he said, I wouldn't just say why, but what are we trying to accomplish? So that was kind of what Kevin Butler said. But I think what's interesting about this book, that the book, and you listen to Perlman talk about the book is about more than these accusations. But it, I think what impacts this, so he might have legitimately started out to write a book about Walter Payton, someone he admired, someone he followed, someone whatever. And in doing a lot of this stuff, you're going to unpack a lot of different things. But when you go to promote something with a publisher in the media in terms of what gets put on the jacket and those different things, these things get pulled out. And even if they're pulled out of context, they're the things that get talked about. So I think this is much more than just about race. It's about promotion of books. It's about how material gets laid out. Because when you do a biography, people are complex people. We're not going to not continue to see biographies. But you know, I think it's an autobiography. It's about complex people. And so what happens is then there's the promotion of a book, which I think it then becomes the issue. And so, you know, part of this is these things get pulled out because they're the ones that help people with readers. They help to promote a lot of different things. So I would say, you know, it's about race, but it's also about how we promote things, how we brand things, how we sell things. And when you then add on top of it an icon, you get something that's really explosive.
Well said. Well said. I think we're going to leave that topic there, and we're going to transition right now. It's a real interesting topic, and it's something that we've revisited. We've talked about a couple of times that I just felt we needed to take a moment with this whole Walter Payton thing and kind of dig into it and talk about that a little bit, because I think it's a very different climate for athletes nowadays. As a parent, you know, the way I grew up idolizing athletes, I really don't want my kids growing up idolizing athletes, because I know something is going to come out, or something could possibly come out, where this particular person has done something that I don't condone, that I'm going to have to explain to my child, and it may not be something that my child can actually comprehend. And so, you know, I think given that there's a lot of layers to the whole story, from the veracity of the media to the lifestyles of athletes, then also the role that parents have to play in protecting their kids from what's going on around them, and helping their kids find solid role models.
Marcus, I would also say we need to be upfront in also letting our kids know that these are individuals with complex lives, and things might happen that you might hear because they are people that you might not be happy about as someone who is admiring.
And I get that, but an 8-year-old
I think
we've
got to have a friend. Yeah, they don't, but they never will. I get it.
And that's a conversation I think you can have with a child.
Yeah.
But ultimately, I don't think they
can. But when we were 8, we couldn't understand it either.
Right. But we didn't have to worry about that. That wasn't necessarily we didn't have to worry. I didn't have to worry about, you know, Walter Payton showing up on the news, you know, that he was drunk at a nightclub or something like that and slapped 3 people.
Yeah.
That wasn't going to get out.
Yeah.
Even if the team beat writer was going to bury that story, the team was going to be able to kind of hush that story, the local media wasn't really going to give that story a whole lot of play because they didn't want to burn any bridges with the organization.
But the next story could be your Reverend Long, who's on the news, you know, because of some other stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Right. That's
you can't get away. We talk about athletes, but they ain't the only ones that we end up connecting with, seeing as moral leaders that end up disappointing us. So the idea of disappointment is something that we have to then prepare our kids for, because it's not just athletes. We got other people who are teachers, all kinds of people in their lives, coaches, all kinds of people in their lives who – they make wrong choices because life, you know, life things happen. So I think that's it shapes the way we have to talk to our kids, and even having conversations that we don't like to have with 8-year-olds, we got to have with 8-year-olds because that's the name of the game.
Hey, I can't argue with that. I can't argue with that. It doesn't make it any easier. I just can't
argue
with it.
I know, Dad. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You lost my team, Phil T, over there like, oh, these brothers are gone. Y'all, we done gone deep down into the hole on this one.
So now we will transition into a segment on the show we like to call Five on the Black Hand Side. Again, if you're listening out there and you want to join in any time, feel free to give us a call at 1-347-989-0844. Let's get into it.
Five on the Black Hand Side.
And I know y'all do this, too. Every time I hear that, when he says, I start to move my head back and forth. I know y'all do that, too.
I can't lie. I do.
I know you do. You can't resist, man. You can't resist. All right. So for this week's Five on the Black Hand Side, we're going Denny Green on them. They are who we thought they were edition. And what we're going to do, we got five NFL friends, NFL teams, and we're going to break down whether these teams are for real. Are they faking the funk? Are these teams overachieving and eventually they're going to come down to earth? Or are they underachieving and eventually we're going to see them turn it on and turn it around and play at the level that we expected them to play at when we talked about these teams in the preseason? The first team we're going to get into are the Philadelphia Eagles, who are currently at 1-3, came into the season, ton of expectations. You know, I ain't really buy it. I don't think any of us really bought that. The whole dream team talk, I think that was kind of – football isn't really made for dream teams. Just I don't think the sport is structured where you can just put a dream team together through free agency like that. But they did make a lot of major moves, a lot of big signings during free agency, so there were high expectations. They were a very good team last year. They seemed to upgrade in certain areas, particularly the secondary. They added some receivers. They added another running back in Ronnie Brown. They added a lot of pieces across the board, but they're 1-3. After the first four games of the season, after the first quarter, they're 1-3. What do we make of this situation right now? I'm going to throw this one to my man, PhD. What do we make of the Eagles?
You know, I'm still in on the Eagles. I still think they have a shot to make the playoffs. They're 1-3 right now, but the thing I like about the 1-3 record, it's not a whole lot to like about 1-3, but I'll find a few things that I do like, is they've been competitive in the games that they lost. And arguably, in two of the games they lost, they were doing okay until Michael Vick got hurt. I like the fact that they haven't had any serious injuries like many of the other teams. So you look at the Steelers right now, they lost one of their pillars on defense for a few weeks in Harrison. You know, look at the Colts. They lost arguably the most valuable player to any team in the league in Peyton Manning. The Eagles right now have not had that serious injury quite yet. And so that leads me to believe that I think they can right the ship. This is the time we're going to see what kind of leaders they have. And honestly, we give, you know, personally, I think we give Andy Reid a little bit more of a pass than we should, but hopefully his 11 years in the system and in the city and with his organization can really pay off and help them steer in the clear waters. So I still think the Eagles can make the playoffs, so I'm still in on them.
Okay, D. Will. Address us, please. The Eagles, where are they going?
Well, I had a couple areas. I'm going to start with tackling in the front seven. They still haven't fixed it. So that was an issue, and that ties into my second point, that just about the nature of football, is whenever you make these kind of changes, things like OTAs and the offseason matter. That football is about continuity, particularly on defense when you got a lot of – it's just not – you just can't put people on the field. Tell Washington, been trying that for years. You got to build continuity, scheme, things like that come back to bite you in a game like football. And then I think it's the thing.
Wait a minute. I'm like, wait, you lucky I ain't got the tape, man, because you got – I said that.
I said that about the Eagles, and y'all
went the other way on me. These guys are too far away from the ball. It's going to be all good. Hey, we all like to be right. It's going to be all good, and they're going to be able to work this out.
I'm not talking about the secondary. I'm talking about the front seven, which is their biggest problem, is that they haven't had a serious front seven play since the passing of the defensive coordinator. And that, I mean, it's just, you don't see that get after you front seven play that's been historically the Eagles. I mean, that's, and part of that's losing people like Dawkins, who serve as that quarterback who can make up for a lot of things. So they got to fix the defense if they're going to make a run. It's got to be, that front seven has got to make those acquisitions in the defensive backfield work. You got to fit that front seven. Some of those folks up there got to start making plays. The other thing I think is about Andy Reid. And this is a part of the game that I don't think he gets. People talk about it, but at some point, you got to realize that you have to do it. His philosophy is not committing to the run. And I think that's what adds to Vic's vulnerability and his injuries, that because they haven't committed enough to the run, that they haven't established McCoy and Brown, haven't really gotten that two-man must to really try to commit to the run, I think it's hurt this team, because I think they could be more explosive if people had to really pay attention to the run. And they got McCoy is as talented as they can be. So I just think that they need to – that's something that he has to do if he's going to turn this around. They're terrible in short yardage, and a lot of that's about attitude and running the football. So, you know, I think a lot of that stuff is tied into this, and I don't know if Andy can change that, because he just has never, as an offensive lineman, committed to the run.
I agree with you guys about Andy Reid. I think he's getting a pass. I think he gets a pass too often, because I've watched in frustration. I can't remember what game it was on their schedule. I think it was last week's game. But I watched as the Eagles were at the one-yard line, and unsuccessfully could not punch it in. First, they ran it with the fullback. They gave it to Owen Schmidt. He went ran into the pile. Couldn't get into the end zone. Then they run Vic. Vic gets hurt on the play. This is the play where he hurt his hand. Vic gets hurt on the play. It was against the Giants. Vic gets hurt on the play. Then they run Owen Schmidt up the middle again. And I'm sitting there, given that I have LeSean McCoy, of course, that's why I was interested. I have LeSean McCoy on one of my fantasy teams. And I'm wondering, are they going to – if God gives him the ball, you have Ronnie Brown, who's a good 230, close 200, somewhere between 240, 230 pounds, and it's a good running back. Give him the ball and let him make it do what it do. I'm sorry, Andy Reid has gotten too much of a pass for too long. You know, Donovan, I don't know what to think of Donovan anymore, but Donovan was damn good when he played under Andy Reid. And maybe Donovan masked some of Andy's flaws, and maybe Andy masked some of Donovan's flaws. But either way, I don't think either one has been that great without the other. Michael Vick can only do so much. Michael Vick is not as durable. And Donovan wasn't durable. I won't say he's not as durable as Donovan, because Donovan wasn't durable. But I do think we've seen this movie before. Andy Reid's style of play calling, I think, you know, when he has quarterbacks who have the ability to move around and run, I think he puts his quarterbacks at risk. And I think you're seeing that a little bit with Mike Vick taking a lot of hits, being in a position where you know, he has to throw for 400 yards and run for 75. And they still lose to the San Francisco 49ers, who are a solid team, but not great by any means. But then also, you know, given all of the moves that they made, you know, they made the glamorous moves in the offseason. Signing Asamoah, bringing in Steve Smith, bringing in Ronnie Brown. But I think you said it, Devonta, and I think you hinted at this, PhD, is that they haven't shored up the trenches. Like, they didn't sign one linebacker. And if you look, Frank Gore was running through a lot of he got to the second level pretty quick, and he was running through a lot of arm tackles when he ran for that game-winning touchdown. And so they didn't shore up the middle, the meat of their defense. And I think they put rims on a Lamborghini instead of making sure that it had a healthy transmission. You know, they shored up the perimeter with adding an all-pro corner in Asamoah, but they just got Rogers Cromartie, DRC, from Arizona, and they already had Asante Samuel in tow. So how much do you need? You know, so I think they got a little too much of something that they already had, they're already strong in, and at the expense of other areas where they were below average. And they could have, with the right signings, at least moved themselves up to average and strengthen their defense. And the one piece that I think people forget is that I think they missed Jim Johnson, the coordinator.
That's right.
You know, he was a really good coordinator, and he gave that defense an identity. He gave that defense that defense had a style. That defense had a flair about it. There was a philosophy to what they did on defense. And when you watch the Eagles, when you've watched the Eagles defenses over the last 2 years when he hasn't been there, they don't look the same. There isn't that aggressiveness. And I think when we were looking at the Asamoah signing, we thought we were going to see that old Eagles defense again where they go man on the outside and they just come, you know, all hell breaks loose and they bring the house at you. But that hasn't been who they are. And even then, they were weak against the run, but they were so daggone aggressive against the pass that it put you in situations where you really couldn't run because you had, you know, 3rd and 14 because you got sacked, or, you know, 2nd and 15. So it took your offense out of run situations. So, verdict on the Eagles. Are they gonna turn it around, or are things gonna fall apart?
Well, I would say that they're in a division where I think they have the opportunity, because I think Dallas has lost gave them an opportunity. You know, the Giants have kind of, you know, it's hard. That division is crazy, but I almost think that given how the Central is playing and how some of these other divisions are playing, like, it feels like you almost got to win that division to make the playoffs. And so I think this next game is going to be pivotal, you know. And if they don't get McCoy, you know, between 20 and 25 rush attempts, I don't know if they can do it. Because I think if they commit to doing that, then the play action and Vic and the big plays are going to come. But I don't know if Andy can do that. It's there to be done. But I don't know if he's patient enough to let that kind of stuff develop. You know, that might mean add a third tight end in there if you don't think you can push people off. You know, it might mean just putting a little different wrinkle in there to try and get leverage on people on the edge or something like that. But, you know, he's got to – you know, New England adjusted, and they put the second tight end, and they started doing some things. I just don't see, you know, even New England started running when they were passing. You know, they started gaining yards. So it's like, I just don't see Andy. But if they can establish a run, I think they can get back in it, because it'll help the defense. If they can't establish that run, then they're going to be at home waiting on the Sixers to start playing.
That's going to be a while. We'll get into that later. PhD. What's your assessment of the situation?
Well, I mean, you're right. You call this out game changer. You call this out Marcus. I saw the Eagles as an 11-12 win team.
I saw him winning. No, I'm not going to front. I'm not going to totally front. I saw them winning games too. But I felt like it was going to take a moment and they were going to struggle a bit because I felt that, you know, adding all these new pieces was going to take a moment because that's football. At least that's what I felt. So I'm going to let you finish.
Well, I mean, I'm still in. I still see them pulling together, going on a run, winning, you know, going 9-4, 9-3 for the rest of the season and pulling out a 9 or 10 win season. I think based on their division, you might be able to win this division with 9 or 10 wins. For me, it just goes back that I believe they have enough playmakers to make stuff happen. I think they have enough. They have enough of the excellent sides to make up for a poorly cooked steak. Okay, so the green, like the collard greens, the candy yams, the cornbread, all that is banging enough that you're gonna be able to look past if the chicken's a little bit dry. So I just think they have enough playmakers. Honestly, on offense and defense, that's going to make up for a lot of their deficiencies. So that's why I think that they can pick it up and still make the playoffs.
I agree. I think they can pick it up. You know, I think they have to win this week. They got to win this week. I think they just got to win. If they don't win this week, 1-4 to me is a tough road to hoe. That's a tough one to overcome. But I think if they can get to 2-3, I still think they got a shot. And we got Ray joining us to complete the square. Ray, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, bro.
Yeah. Well, I've been
so right now. Go ahead.
Well, I'm listening to what you guys are saying, and I think that the only thing I could add to that is that, you know, Philadelphia didn't add any bad players. You know, everybody that they brought in this year with somebody that you know and somebody that can do a job. And right now, you know, the team as a whole is not getting it done. So whatever they may be lacking on offense, you know, they are lacking just as much on defense. So this is still a good ball team. And I think that you're right. If they win this weekend, they could be well on their way. And I think that they have to put some wins underneath their belts to have something to go on. You know, to sit and pick apart, you know, exactly where in their game they have to make changes, you know, it's simply a matter of coming to work with the lunchbox and getting it done.
Well said. Let's slide into our second team, the Minnesota Vikings, sitting at 0-4. Again, this is a team that at this time a year ago, they were still in serious contention to make it to a Super Bowl. You know, this is a team that everybody, they were coming off the great year that Brett Favre had where he threw 30 touchdowns and just 3 picks. And early last season, they were still thought of as a team that could contend for a title. You know, and how quickly things change. Now they're sitting in 0-4. And I'm just wondering, what do we make of the Minnesota Vikings? I'm going to toss this one to D. Wills. You go ahead and weigh in first, brother. Actually, I want Phil T to weigh in. I want Phil T to weigh in.
All right, go ahead, Phil.
Marcus went with the ball fake, didn't you, Devon?
Yeah, that was a little pump fake. Oh, look.
That was a pump fake?
You know, I was telling you, Marcus, before the show, thinking about Jim McKay, the coach of the Buccaneers, when they didn't win a game years ago, you know, he said, you know, we didn't block anybody, but that was okay. We made up for it by not tackling anybody. And, just thinking about the Vikings have found ways to lose. They've been very creative with how they've been losing. And I think when that kind of stuff happens, teams can go either two ways. They can take the approach of, you know what, we're better than this. We could easily be 3-1 or 2-2 right now. Or they can take the approach of, you know what, this thing has been going downhill since Brett Favre was here. You know, I mean, this whole thing can go downhill, and all of a sudden they just have a rough season with one or two wins. My brain wants me to say that they're only going to win a few games this year, but my heart keeps saying, wait a minute, this is a team that, you know, 13, 14 months ago, we were saying they had, like, they could potentially win a Super Bowl. And much of those pieces are still there. So I guess I'm going to go with my heart here and say that I think they'll win a few games. They'll have a respectable season, 6, 7, 8 wins. Even saying that, that means that I'm predicting that they're going to go 500 for the rest of the season. So I guess I'll follow my heart with this one.
Okay, okay. Good assessment. Good assessment. This is something I'm going to throw out to Ray. I'm going to throw this one out to Ray because I know I'm going to get a good solid response from Ray. Who do we blame for this, Ray? Who do we blame for the Vikings being 0-4 right now? Is it Favre? Is it the ghost of Brett Favre?
No, I don't think it's the ghost of Brett Favre. Well, it is chilly, and I think it goes back to chilly, and I think it goes back to the owner, and I think it goes back to the whole management style. You know, when Minnesota started their prominence, they were one of the strongest defensive teams in the league, and so they built their offense up to accentuate that and to come up with that. And they had a small window of opportunity before these guys got old or moved on or whatever. And what happened was I think that they pressed themselves a little bit offensively and didn't show up their defense as it was aging. And I'm not in agreement with Phil. I think Minnesota's a terrible football team. I think they are who they are. Will they win a few games? Sure, it's football, and emotions can come in, and a game or two can be pulled out, and you know there are going to be some you know cupcakes in the schedule, you know, where they will beat teams that are, you know, less than what they are, and there are a few of them. But you know, I think the truth of the matter is that Minnesota is a prime example of poor management, and prime example of what happens when you build one side before the other, and then it doesn't come together at all. You know, they got to a point where they were a quarterback shy of winning a Super Bowl, and they relied on Brett Favre, and he almost got them there. But then the wheels started to fall off, and they're a team in a downspin, and it's going to take a while for Minnesota to come back. I don't think they're a good football team. They to me are where, you know, the Cowboys were maybe 2 years ago. And we'll see how they pull this out, you know.
Where do we set the over-under at how many more games McNabb starts before they put the rookie in?
Well, I don't put that rookie in until he's ready to play. I'm not a firm believer in that you start bringing in this young talent and bringing them around. I think you start the best.
Yeah, Ray, you don't believe that. That don't mean they do.
Well, I'm just saying, you know.
I mean, you know how these teams think, though, man.
I didn't bring Donovan McNabb in to sit the bench. I brought him in to start because I thought he was the best quarterback available. And Donovan might, you know, have a say in that, too, because if he keeps getting beat up, you know, there comes a point where you have to look, you know, 10 years down the road. And, you know, it isn't just Donovan, you know, stinking the place up. The Minnesota Vikings, I just don't think they're a good football team. And they were more than a player away when they got Favre. I mean, it was obvious that Favre wasn't enough. And I think their mentality was, well, we'll just replace Favre with the next best thing. You know, we'll get this winning quarterback, this guy that can, you know, go into the huddle and make things happen. And what you're seeing up in Minnesota is not Donovan McNabb's fault. He's not helping matters. But he's not the core of the issues that they have. On that defensive side of the football team, they are not the same team they were 3 years ago, and they have to accept that.
If I had to set the over under on the Vikings, I think I'm gonna give them three games. If they lose two out of those three games, Ponder's coming in. I think it'd be a mistake. I agree with you, Ray. You don't put him in unless he's ready.
Right.
I think it'd be a mistake to put him in and throw him out there. But at this point, I have no proof that this organization would do anything different other than make another
mistake.
They
kept Chile as long as they did. They did a lot of things that you just – that's what I'm saying. You know, Minnesota needs, you know, help in the office first that will spread down to the team. And if they don't change what they're doing in the office, this team might not be around, you know, might not, you know, come around for a while.
I want to add to the conversation that there are two stats that tell a lot of the story. 18 for 50 and 26 for 57. That's third down conversions. The Vikings have 26% third down conversions versus their opponents have a 50% third down conversions. So they're not their defense isn't getting off the field, and their offense isn't making the plays to stay on the field. And so there's some things that they just have to do. They haven't figured out. It's one of the things that I appreciate about great coaches, that they can make adjustments. They have the talent to make the adjustment, but they got to see it. It also speaks to the fact that they don't have Sidney Rice. They don't have a guy who can make some plays down the field a little bit. They haven't figured out how to integrate their tight ends back into the passing game very much, because they really need their tight ends to be in the passing game right now. They need ways to move those chains, take some of the pressure off of Adrian Peterson, at the same time giving him his quality carries. I just don't see that philosophy evolving. I think they've been struggling offensively around the philosophy, and I think that was part of Favre coming in and shaking that up. They haven't settled in to something, and they went away from Adrian as the sole kind of person driving it. I think they got a good combination between Adrian and Donovan, if they can find a way to get those tight ends back in the game and start moving the chains. Defensively, they've got to get off the field. And so part of it is those things can be corrected. Now, I have a feeling they might end up winning seven games. I think they might end up winning seven games. I think they might put some things together because they're talented enough. I think they're talented enough to do it. But they're going to have to make some of those. When I watch them, because their problem isn't they can't get the lead. They've had the lead and just wanted it. So that's telling me that they haven't been able to convert, make some of those plays to keep the drives going late in the game. And that's the stuff that they need to correct. Those are correctable things. You know, if whether or not, or, and at the same time, they're trying to get this money for this new stadium. So there's a lot of pieces here in play to decide when you go to Ponder, when you stick with McNabb. The other thing is, are you going to be in the Andrew Luck sweepstakes now that you have Ponder? So, but the stuff on the field, those are two glaring statistics. Good teams convert on third down.
I totally agree with you, Devon. And what I will say is that, to me, there's really no good reason a team with Adrian Peterson in their backfield should ever squander a 17-point lead.
That's right.
And what you're saying, I agree with what you're saying about the third down conversion. And what I'll say to that is, to me, that's not a coaching thing. That's personnel. You don't have the personnel to convert on third downs. If they could convert on third downs, they should be able to milk any clock. With a 17-point lead against the Vikings, it should be a wrap with Adrian Peterson in the backfield. It should be done and over with.
But also,
you got the best running back in the league. And your offensive line isn't terrible. It's not as good as it was, but it's still very good.
But, Jenkins, the thing you're hitting on it is that I also think they don't really understand how to use Percy Harvin. I think when I look at him, I don't think they utilize him well. I don't think they utilize their tight end situation well. I think if you look at the series of how they call plays and set things up, you know, yeah, you have Adrian, but there are times when you might – play action on first down, hit your tight end, get the chains, and then playing Adrian right back in the game. So sometimes it's the sequence of how you call the plays that matters, rather than because if everybody's going to load the box on first down and Adrian only gets you to a yard, now you're in second and long. Now you either go back to Adrian anyway and be bullish about it, or if you pass on there, you don't convert because you don't have anybody to get separation. Now you at third and long. So if you watch them sometimes, especially late in the game, when I watch a couple of games, those are the kind of sequences they would have. And it just would frustrate me because you're right. They got the personnel to make the plays. It doesn't. It's just a combination of game plan, play calling, all that stuff. When you watch it, it's like it just doesn't make a lot of sense, and it puts pressure on the defense. I think the reason why the defense is not doing well because they're taking a lot of chances because they feel like they got to stop the bleeding.
Well, that's why I disagree with you, D. If they had the personnel, they'd be making those plays. I think with this.
No,
team,
but you can have personnel and just have coaches who can't call stuff.
Well, but you got to. To me, when I'm in the situation that Minnesota's in, I'm doing as many trick plays and as many goofy ass plays as I can, because they are so predictable in what they're going to do on first and second down that they really got to come out of that mold. If they had the personnel just to drive that, if they found themselves with, you know, third and three, third and four every time, you know, and had the personnel to go ahead and get those third downs, you know, they would do that. But they don't have that personnel. So when they do find themselves, you know, third and six, third and eight, you know, because there's stuff in the box and Adrian can't get off, they don't have the personnel to go out there and get things done. So what you have to do is figure out how you're going to get Adrian Peterson two more steps, you know, into that line of scrimmage and into that defense's, you know, grill. And to me, if I'm just strictly going to win ball games, is that I'm going to do something a heck of a lot different than I'm doing right now, because right now, you know, they're getting to those third and six, third and eights, and not converting. And so that tells me that they just don't have the personnel to play smash mouth, you know, football.
But they seem to be doing that enough to get the lead. So they're doing it. So what you do down the stretch requires you to develop the wrinkles. They got the tight ends to do what New England's doing. Not with the greatest degree that New England's doing it, but they got tight ends. They can run three tight end sets. They got stuff
sure.
to do that.
Sure.
So, like,
sure.
But that requires you as a coach to be thinking about that. And I don't see that. And this is the thing I had when they had Favre. I said, for them to win with Favre, they had to do what they did with Elway and Davis.
Sure.
And I don't see them. I see them continuing to continuously not making those kind of adjustments, and those are things they can't do, they can't control, they just don't do it. And I see that,
right.
Like, that's a problem. That tells you that there's something wrong with the philosophy or the organization. They got the talent. Their talent isn't 0-4 talent. They had the lead. They at least should be 2-2, but it's part of systemic to their culture that they have. And I know they try to change that, but when you watch them, it's that kind of stuff that just kills you. And third down conversions, I always look at that. Tell me a lot about that, particularly when you had the lead. If you had the lead that often, you should have a third down conversion at 26%.
All right. So D, you're saying they can get to seven games. I think Ray is out on them. I'm out on them. Phil T, are you in or out on the Vikings? I think you said you was kind of still on the fence with them, right?
Yeah, I think they can get to 6 or 7 wins this year.
All right. Okay, so we got three more teams we got to get to. I want to get to these teams before we hit the 10 o'clock hour, and then we're going to continue with the show from there. All right, we got St. Louis at 0-4. And we all had them winning the NFC West, which they could still do. They could still win. But it don't look good right now. It don't look good at all. I'll begin with this one. Phil T, I know you picked Bradford as a possible sleeper MVP candidate.
Did you write that down?
Oh, man, that's cold.
I'm saying you did, though.
I mean, you just put it out there and then tried to move on.
What am I supposed to do?
We all questioned on that one.
But
yeah, that's. I think Ray even laughed at me that night.
I'm sorry.
But it's not panning out right now for Bradford, and I don't think it's his fault. I don't think it's his fault at all. I don't think he has enough around him. Jackson's been banged up. The offense is pedestrian. The defense isn't playing up to the level it was playing at last year. If I had to pick a coach to get fired before the end of the season, I'd have a hard time picking between Spagnuolo and Sperano in Miami. One of those two guys, because with St. Louis, I feel like they're really underperforming. I think expectations were higher this year, and 0-4 start is unacceptable when you have expectations. And I think the Dolphins just look terrible. So I would imagine that their coach would be on the hot seat. So if I had to put two coaches on the hot seat, it would be Spagnuolo in St. Louis and Sperano in Miami. St. Louis situation, they can still salvage some of their season because they do happen to play in the NFC West, which is kind of a JV league. At least it has been for the last couple of years. Maybe as the season progresses, somebody will step up and really present themselves as a legitimate playoff team, a legitimate potential contender in that division. But St. Louis still has a shot. And it looks like their schedule does become more favorable down the stretch, but they got a deep hole to climb out of at 0-4.
I was going to say what I said to my sophomore students: avoid the sophomore slump. This is a sophomore slump. They're not getting out of this. I don't think Spagnuolo will get fired. I just think that he's changing the culture. And I think that's the ebb and flow to learn how to win. You know, you start feeling yourself, and then you come back, take a bump. I think they'll come back the next year. And he's got the right parts. I think, you know, Bradford is getting into that sophomore year. I mean, people had a chance to look at a year of film. So, I think they might end up winning, you know, five games. I think their defense will pull it together. I think they'll figure out how to win some games, and they'll win, you know, maybe five games. But, you know, I think it's just a sophomore slump for that team.
Have any of you ever played on the 0-4 team?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was the end result of that 0-4 team?
0-9.
That's exactly it. You know, I played on the
0-4
team.
It depends on the team.
And I don't know if it does.
Because the 0-4 team is not a good football team. It's just not. And we can sit here and speculate, and we can talk about the culture. The culture of an 0-4 team is ducking. Them guys blink every time they hear a loud noise. You know, it's a culture of fear. You know, they're looking around the locker rooms trying to figure out which one I'm gonna go first, because somebody's going. You know, somebody's got to go. You know when it gets to be 0-5, you know, somebody slams a locker and guys are gonna hit the floor. You know, it's like growing up in Compton. You hear a loud noise, you hit the floor. It's a bad situation. And so, you know, which one of these 0-4 teams might have a chance to win more games than the other 0-4 team? Well, then, you know, that's a conversation we can have. But 0-4, come on, guys. Right now, you know, I played on 0-4 team. And as much talent as we thought we had, you can't talk about the talent we have when we're 0-4, you know? You know, we got good towels, you know? You know, the clipboard is new. What do we got? So, I mean, these are teams trying to find something to talk about, you know, hoping that something good. You can't go play football hoping you're going to do well. You know, like at 0-4, you're just hoping you ain't going to get hurt. 0-4 is 0-4.
Hey, we got Ray on one.
That's all that needs to be said, man. That's all that needs
to
be said.
Yeah, we're going to move on. Ray broke that one down, man. The mic is waving. He said 0-4 is 0-4. That's what it is. All right, with that said, we're going to move on to the number 14, and that's the Pittsburgh Steelers. They're sitting at 2-2. Big Ben is banged up. not a lot of power in their power running game, and the defense just looks ordinary. It's just one of those years where the Steel Curtain kind of just retools. They kind of have a 9-7, 8-8 year, figure out what's going on, retool, shore up the weak areas, and then come back strong the next year. Or are they really in for a rough season this year? I'm gonna throw this one to the resident Steeler fan.
I didn't want to talk about it. No, I could talk about one play I watched in the Houston game that says it all about their defense. When I saw the nose guard at the second level cutting off the linebacker's path, I said, I see the problem. You know, their problem right now, is particularly defensively, is in that middle of their front line. You know, they get pushed around and not getting penetration, and that's just not a good sign. And so I think they're struggling offensively. You know, they just don't run the ball with any consistency. They're still buying into what I call the Ben Kool-Aid. Ben is good at a certain number of passes, but don't try and make him Peyton Manning. And so I think they'll make a run, but I'm saying this now, I don't see any kind of Super Bowl run. If they make the playoffs, I feel good about it. But they're going to be second fiddle to the Ravens this year. Ravens looked like beasts the other day. And that's how the Steelers used to look. I just don't see anybody in that front seven, you know, on the interior that scares me on the defense, and that's a problem. That's that Mike Tomlin honesty.
Anybody else
want to
jump in on the Steelers?
That's that Mike Tomlin honesty.
I tell you what, hey, I can see my time to the man from Beloit. I can see my time to Ray. Ray was on one. Go right ahead.
I look at the Steelers. Again, now here you can talk about culture, Devon. I have to disagree with you. I think at 2-2, I remember last year you said if the Steelers were 2-2, they were going to make the playoffs. But they were going to get Ben back and everything was going to be wonderful. And it's about, you know, what were they, 3-1? I mean,
but they're playing with some dog. They were 2-2 with a backup quarterback playing with some dog. Right now, they're
lucky,
not playing with that dog.
There you go. If they can find that dog, because they don't have to find that talent. That talent is there. They have talent. They have to find that dog. And the one thing about, you know, a team that has had as much success as the Steelers is that they've been there before. You know, there's not a whole lot of panic, you know, in Pittsburgh. Not in the locker room. I mean, they didn't panic last year when Ben was, you know, paying for that stuff that he did. I don't even know how to describe it.
I don't even know what to call it, but you know, the stuff that boy did.
Yeah, well, you know what I'm saying? I mean, if you were going to be down, you had an excuse to be down. You say, well, you know, we ain't going to be that good because, you know, Ben paying for that stuff that he did. You know, we ain't got Ben. They came right out and played football. This year, I think that the slow start might be attributed more to the fact that they didn't come out as prepared. Maybe they didn't come out as hungry. But at 2-2, I think you'll see the Pittsburgh Steelers, you know, get hungry real quick. You know, and that's the difference. You know, they know that they can play at a much higher level, and pride will step in. You know, I do agree with you that they may take the back seat to the Ravens because the Ravens are looking, you know, beastly. They're just looking. They've got a chip on their shoulder, and that comes from getting beat down a bit. But you have to remember that this is Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh is used to doing the beating. And they won't take the back seat to the Ravens if they, you know, I mean, it'll be a fight. It'll be a real fight. I see Pittsburgh coming back. I see Pittsburgh making the playoffs. Maybe they don't win their division, but I see them in the playoffs, and I see them, you know, being a standout Pittsburgh team. That stuff don't go away. You know, you can get the dog back.
Let's slide that one on. That's a great take. Let's slide this one on to number five. We got the Buffalo Bills. They're sitting at 3-1. They blew a lead late against the Cincinnati Bengals. And they probably should be sitting at 4-0 right now. Nobody had any expectations for the Bills coming into the season. In my opinion, they're probably the biggest surprise. If you had told me after four games what would the Buffalo Bills record be, I would have them at 1-3 or 0-4 after their first four games. So for them to be 3-1 and had a good opportunity to be undefeated at this point in the season is a huge surprise. So can they keep this up? That's the question I pose to the RSG crew right now. Can the Bills keep this up? Ray, go ahead and run with that one real quick.
Well, I'll be real quick. You know, I would have thought the same thing of the Bears last year. Look what they did. And I think every year you come across a team like that. They're doing what they need to win, and they get a little bit of luck here and there, but they're playing good football. So, you know, I think that they're legitimate, but I don't see them, you know, making real big noise, and I don't know if it's lasting, you know, because I think where they're getting their success isn't sustainable. So, you know, I think that they'll win games, but I thought about the Bears about the same way last year, and look what they did.
Good point. Phil T, the Bills, they hanging in there, or are you selling on them? You buying a stock, or are you selling it?
I'm selling because I'm forced to choose between them and the Jets in terms of which team is going to turn around or which team is going to sustain. And I believe more about the Jets and their ability to turn things around than I do about Buffalo sustaining it. And to me, the Jets just have more tools there. I think if they get back to running the ball, Sanchez has improved. He's improved, but he's not to the point where they can win it on his arm every week. And I think once they get that balance, the Jets are going to be a good football team that wins second place in that division. And unfortunately, that leaves the Bills, the odd people out, because the Pats will win that division.
Yeah, I think I'm falling into that same category where I like the Bills. I like the step that they've taken as a franchise, as an organization. They've got some young talent. They got a decent quarterback. I'm still not sure how good Fitzpatrick is, but, hell, he's winning games. And ultimately, that's all that anybody really cares about. I don't know if they got that Chiefs magic. I don't think they play in a weak enough division to do what the Kansas City Chiefs did last year when they kind of came out of nowhere. So I'm selling on the Bills as well. I think the Jets will eventually surpass them. So I think I fall into the same camp as Phil T on the Bills. Hey, Wills, where are you standing?
I think that the Bills are a solid story. I don't quite touch the Jets. I mean, I'm wavering on Sanchez. When I looked at him this weekend, I mean, those are kind of games that you got to see if somebody bounce back from. I mean, the Ravens literally abused them. So I think the Bills are solid, and I think they might get that final playoff spot.
Okay. So you think the Bills hanging in there, they pick up that playoff spot. So we're going to see where these predictions go. We're going to see how all of these teams progress when we check in at the halfway point. We'll check in on these particular storylines and other storylines as we continue to march through the NFL season. Now, we got about a half hour left. I want to jump into the pick six really quick. We're going to skip the freestyle and go into the pick six and get our picks in before we run out of time. All right? D. Wills, I got to refresh. You got to refresh me on your picks last week. Because you gave me the text, but I have a prehistoric phone, so I can't talk on my phone and look at text at the same time. I just can't do that. Technology is beyond me. So what I need for you is to refresh. We had the Jets in Baltimore. Who did you take?
Hold on a second. I'm trying to pull that up.
Who you do. I got to pull that up.
I gotta pull that up. You see that? Man, I got all this. Okay, here we go. I think it's Jets over Ravens.
Okay, so you got one loss. All right, then we have Minnesota, Kansas City.
Minnesota over KC. Battle of the shoulda couldas.
All right, and who you have Minnesota in that one?
Yep.
Okay, that's another loss.
Damn.
Detroit against Dallas. Who you have in
Detroit,
that one?
Detroit
okay,
over
so
Dallas,
you gotta win there.
Eight mile over Big D.
Okay, so you had that one. Then we had Wisconsin over. We had Wisconsin and Nebraska. I bet you had Wisconsin winning.
I had Wisconsin. Then I had Alabama.
Okay, so you
and then
got there.
I got Texas A&M.
Okay, so you went 3-3. So at the end of last week, you were sitting in first place at 12-6. This week, you're at 15-9. PhD is at 15-9. And I went 4-2 last week, losing it with Florida and losing with Minnesota against Kansas City and getting all the other ones right. So I'm at 12-500, man. This mediocrity is killing me, man. I gotta get over the hump, man. I take two steps forward and take two steps back. All right, so this week, Game Changer gets on track. So for the pick six this week, we got Philly at Buffalo, game one. Me and PhD already weighed in with our picks. Who'd you have? Refresh my memory, brother.
I went with Philly.
Yeah, Philly. Hey, he's going Philly. I'm going Philly. I figured they got to win this game. D-Wills, why don't you weigh in real quick?
Sorry about that. And I coughed on that pick. But I'm gonna go with Philly.
All right. So you got Philly. Ray, who are you taking? Philly or Buffalo? At Buffalo.
I'll take Philly. I think they need it more.
Okay. So Ray's going Philly as well. And I agree, they do need this win. QB Eagles better step up and bring it. I mean, he brought it last week, but they still lost. Second game for week five, we got the Jets at the Patriots. This is a breaking point for the Jets, in my opinion. They got to keep pace not only with the Patriots, but the Bills. I'm taking the Patriots at home. Phil T's taking the Patriots at home. Who y'all got?
I'm taking the Patriots.
Ray, who you taking?
I'm going to have to take the Patriots as well. I think the Jets are still holding stuff, you know. Somebody holding their chin, somebody holding their ear. They got the hell beat out of it.
I was wondering, I was like, what do you mean they still holding stuff? Now I get it. I got it. Game Changer caught up on that one. So then we got the unstoppable force known as the Green Bay Packers going in to the Georgia Dome to take on the Atlanta Falcons. Phil T win Atlanta. I'm going with the Packers. They just look too damn good. Ray, who you got in this game?
Well, you know, right now I think Atlanta's still—they're still stung from that loss of last year. But this Green Bay team is just right now playing unbelievable football. I mean, they ain't even showed all their cards yet. So I'll stick with Green Bay until they show me a reason not to. Somebody really might
all
have
right.
to get hurt.
Yeah. Phil T. D-Wills, who you taking? I know who Phil T's taking.
This is a toss-up because, you know, I haven't been as high on Atlanta. I'm going to go with Green Bay until they prove that they can play.
Yeah. All right. And, I mean, I usually would go because I feel like these teams are fairly close as far as the matchup goes.
Right.
But it's really, really hard for me to vote against the Packers right now. I mean, they're so damn crisp on offense. The defense does just enough. And ultimately, I think this is probably where me and all of us at Phil T differ, is that I don't trust Matt Ryan. But I think Phil T has faith in Matt Ryan at home, and Matt Ryan has a track record of doing well at home. He's been hard to beat in the dome. But I just think Green Bay is too daggone good right now. Like I said, at the beginning of the season, I think they got a 14-13 wins. I think if they don't win 14-13 games, I'm actually going to be surprised. And that's what I feel about that team.
Does this seem to, you know, before we get into these college picks, does this seem to anybody else besides me that Aaron Rodgers, if ever he gets in trouble, anytime he really wants to, can go to Jermichael Finley for a first down or a touchdown or whatever he wants to do? I mean, I watch the way he spreads the ball around, and it's almost as if, well, at least for these first games, as if they're at practice. They're just trying to figure out what works. They ain't trying to beat nobody. They're not trying to win ball games. They're just going out there and running the plays, and these are the results that they have. That's why I think this team is so good, is that almost everything they do is golden right now. And it just seems as if, you know, they put players on the shelf just so that you can't really, you know, figure them out.
Yeah, and I think the team, there's two times the teams that will challenge them is what they face against New Orleans. So if they played in New Orleans, but just playing against New Orleans, a team that can keep up with them on scoring, but on defense can do enough to upset their rhythm, or a team that can put pressure with their front four. And if you got a front four that can control things, then that's the kind of team. And I don't see Atlanta as being that team could either do either of those things on defense yet. Not enough confident with their defense enough to say that they can step up to Green Bay on that and control enough with their front four.
You know,
now, Phil
I think
T. went Atlanta. I want Phil T. to weigh in because he went with Atlanta. So I wanted this brother to explain himself.
We're going to write this down. We got to write it down. Phil T. say something. His job's written down.
I mean, well, quite honestly, Marcus, I couldn't have said it better myself when you were speaking my words. I like Atlanta. Quite honestly, again, like I said a few weeks ago, I don't see Green Bay as a 13 or 14 or 15 win team. I see them more as 11 or 12 wins. And so as I'm looking through their schedule, I'm trying to figure out where can they lose games. And it's not that I like the matchup. I like Atlanta in this matchup. Honestly, I think it goes back to one premise. Like Cedric the Entertainer said, one premise, payback. Last year, Atlanta won, 14 games, 13 games? And Green Bay came in and beat them like they stole something. I just think that playing at home, the Dirty Bird is going to be ready. That's just my gut feeling.
Okay.
Hey, you got to go with something. All right. We got Oklahoma at Texas, Red River Shootout, neutral site game, anything goes, rivalry, blood feud, whatever you want to call it. It's going to be a throwdown. DLT went OU. I went Texas. D. Wills, who you got?
I'm going. I already told you I picked who was going to win the Heisman, Landry Jones. So I'm going with OU.
All right. Ray, who you taking?
I take Oklahoma in that one.
All right. Man, everybody going to Oklahoma. I'm hoping Oklahoma loses because then it opens the door for the Badgers to kind of sneak in and get into that BCS championship conversation. Because as long as OU and one-loss SEC team are at play, I don't think they got a shot. So I'm rooting. That's where my rooting interests lie. That's why I just want Texas to win. I don't really think they're going to win. I want them to win.
Well,
so I'm going to pick them to win.
I do, too. I just don't. I just think Oklahoma's going to take this game from them.
Yeah. So then the next game, college football game, we got it. Florida at LSU. I picked LSU. Phil, PhD, picked LSU. And I think what we'll see is I think this will be a close game. I think LSU, Lee is going to struggle a little bit. Jefferson's going to get in there and lead them to victory. And that's going to be that. We're not going to see Lee again for the rest of the year. Jordan Jefferson's going to hold it down. And LSU is going to continue to roll until they face Alabama, and we'll see what happens then. I can't call that one yet. But that's why I picked LSU. That's how I see the game going. Ray, who are you taking? LSU? LSU's at home. Florida at LSU.
That defense at home, you can't go against LSU.
All right. B. Wills.
Hey, LSU is like a college version of them Ravens. They look like they don't look like they playing defense. It looks like they beat you up. like a gang initiation when they play. Upside down on there. It's like Georgetown against the Chinese team.
He's joked in
all kinds of stuff. So I just want to call the. I don't want to call a flag. I want to call the police. That's on the LSU.
Oh my goodness! All right. The next game we got Ohio State, the Ohio State Buckeyes, journeying to Lincoln, Nebraska. Both teams coming off of bad losses. Both teams had pretty decent expectations this year. Nebraska still has, still is in the position to do well and come out with a decent bowl bid. Ohio State's got some work to do. They got some ground to cover and some ground to make up. This would go a win on the road against the Nebraska team would go a long way to helping Ohio State get back on track. Who gets this one? Phil T chose Ohio State. I chose Nebraska. D. Wills, who are you taking?
The black shirts like the pink shirts on Saturday. I will say that. The one thing about it is, does Ohio State get those players back today for this game?
I don't know. I think they lost a couple more, actually.
Damn.
Probation.
But this is a hard game. Because the one thing about Nebraska, they're going to find in the Big Ten, you just can't be that one-dimensional. Because Big Ten teams going to eat you up every week. Damn, it's tough. I'm going to go with Nebraska because Bo Pelini looked like he was about to shoot somebody. on the sidelines, and I just don't think he's gonna mess up come in the media. The look on his face, man, it was set his face like
damn.
He's
yelling at them kids, man.
I know the college president
every time
called
they showed
time.
Him, he was yelling at a kid. He was yelling at some kid. Every time they showed him, he was yelling at somebody.
The look on his face, I was like, damn, somebody getting beat tonight. He gonna kick the dog. He gonna do all kinds of stuff tonight.
Then he had that look on his face, just get out of my sight. Just go away.
That's it.
I don't even want to look at you no more.
But how often do you see the head coach, a player gets burnt on the side, How often do you see the head coach just tear into somebody like that? Usually, the head coach just lets him run by, knowing that the assistant coach is going to chew him a new ass. But he was stopping getting his bite, and then sending him back to the assistant. It was classic. The one thing that I will say about Nebraska, in the beginning of that football game last week, Nebraska came into Wisconsin. That was not a friendly environment. Wisconsin was packed. Wisconsin does what Wisconsin does best, and for the fan support, I realize that there were a lot of people from Nebraska there, but for the most part, it was Wisconsin. And they're not a hostile crowd. Wisconsin will spill beer on you. They ain't going to try to fight you, They're going to sing you out the stadium, They're going to be rolled out the barrel and shit, But that's the home with them early in that game. Nebraska's offense is fairly sound. And that's why I'll take Nebraska this weekend. If you thought that them boys got yelled at that football game, what do you think that ride home was like? What do you think what do you think this week of practice is going to be like? You don't think he sat in that film room and just pointed with a big laser pointer and said, "Did you see that block you missed? Did you see that tackle you missed? Did you see that assignment you blew?" Those kids are to me, Nebraska's going to come out I would not want to be Ohio State this week. And as much as they should have higher expectations, I would not want to be Ohio State because Nebraska probably felt that they were coming into Wisconsin and they were going to show the Big Ten what football was all about. And they went home, you know, just in sad shape.
Yeah, it was kind of told them, this ain't going to go the way you think it's going to go.
Right, exactly. And but again, if you remember that beginning of the game when Wisconsin was putting up points, they were putting up points. You know, they were going toe-to-toe for a minute, but they just got that this year, you know.
Wisconsin is like a good body-punching boxer.
Yeah.
I think them early rounds you're getting through, but you start – it's like when Oscar De La Hoya got hit. Was that – I forget who he was fighting when he got hit right in
the kid.
He went down. He went down. That's how Wisconsin football team be. At a certain point you get paralyzed and you wake up and you down 3 touchdowns. They put you to sleep. But, Nebraska – but Nebraska's learned that's going to be week to week. And you're going to come out of some of these stadiums sore. You know, you can't take that stuff to Michigan State. You're going to come out, they might be 6-6, but they hurt everybody they play.
And that's the Big Ten, and that's what Nebraska is going to find out. You know, there isn't a team in the Big Ten that you try to finesse.
Yeah.
There isn't a team in the
Big
Ten.
Ain't no Missouri.
Exactly. You don't take
a
week off. That's why you see more than half of Wisconsin's preseason games are cupcakes. Because when they get into that Big Ten, you know, it's not so much about the game. It's about, you know, did you see me hit him? Did you see me hit him? I hit him, didn't I? You know,
yeah.
You see that.
Now, before we get into our dogs of the week, I want to continue this college football conversation just for a moment. Does the fact that the Big Ten isn't extremely strong this year, does that hurt Wisconsin's chances of cracking getting to that BCS championship game? Because Oklahoma has multiple ranked teams left on their schedule. LSU has multiple ranked teams. Alabama has multiple ranked teams. But LSU and Alabama will play each other at some point. And we can just bet on there being an SEC team there, even with one loss. I think an SEC team gets in over an undefeated Big Ten team this year, even with one loss, depending upon who that loss is to, of course. But if LSU loses to Alabama or Alabama loses to LSU, I don't think that's necessarily going to hurt their ability to play in the title game. I think there's going to be an SEC team there. How would you handicap Wisconsin's chances at this point? Be quick. We got about 5-7 minutes left.
I would quickly say Wisconsin wins on an eyeball test. And what people saw on the weekend is the way in which they win. It's a thud. It's like when you watch a boxer, you're not quite sure about his competition, but the way in which he throw that knockout blow tell you that when you put in your top 10 competition, it's not going to change. So it's the way in which they've been winning. I think that's winning them, you know, that kind of pushing up the rankings a little bit this week. And so I think they'll get serious consideration. But I do think that one lost SEC team will be good. And we got the championship this year, right? So I think, you know, if Michigan or one of these other teams are good coming out of the other division and it's a really good championship game, I also think that allows for Wisconsin to have another opportunity to demonstrate what they're all about on a national stage.
All right.
I agree. I think that Wisconsin actually, this championship game is actually to their benefit, because in the past we've seen this formula where a team can be undefeated in one conference, but this one loss SEC team can still ride it out. I think with the Big Ten, it's still to be seen, because if the Badgers go undefeated and win this championship game, I don't see another team in another conference that's going to go undefeated. I don't believe in Stanford. I think the SEC is too deep. I don't see an undefeated team coming out of there.
I don't see one coming out of the Big 12, and I certainly don't see one coming out of the Big East or the ACC. So, quite honestly, I think that Wisconsin is in the driver's seat because if they keep playing the way they're playing, they're going to get bumped up in the rankings.
Well, I will say I'm hoping that happens. I think they just got to keep winning and keep winning the way they've been winning, and I think they'll have an opportunity to play in that game, to play in the championships. And that brings us to the dogs of the week.
Cat's still going crazy in there. And I told our players, you need to be more like a dog. We don't need a bunch of cats in here. Looking in the mirror. Do I look good? I got my extra bands on. I got my other shoes on. Be a dog. We don't need no meows. We don't need no cats. We need more dogs.
Gets me every time. So, I'll start it off. For my dog of the week, I got my man Every Day I'm Russellin'. I had to go with Russell Wilson, man. Like I said, this cat could run for mayor of Madison, and he would win hands down in a landslide right now. The kid is poised. The kid is good. If the kid was 6'2", he'd be a top-10 draft pick. And I still think he goes in the first four rounds of the NFL draft at 5'11". The kid can play the quarterback position. And he's got moxie. He's a winner. He gets it. And it's been said a lot about him, but it's true. So Russell was my guy for this week. But as always,
we need more dogs.
PLT, who you got?
Well, I got a cat, too. My cat is Alex Rodriguez. I need for you to step it up, man. My dog...
He gave us a cat. I just caught that, man. I'm sorry. Keep going, bro.
My dog is U of M's football team. They beat up Minnesota 58-0, undefeated. Way to go, Big Blue.
All right. D-Wills.
I got to go with the man that's going to get a lot of people at NC State fired. And I got to go with Russ because I think he was the turning point in that game. There were times where they put pressure on him. He took a little sidestep, kept his poise, made incredible plays. I think, you know, America had a chance to see a star being born.
All right, Ray, who you got as your dog of the week?
Well, I got multiple dogs. I like the way that the Baltimore Ravens just slapped the piss out of the Jets.
That's right.
I know Rex Ryan didn't even look at no feet when he went home. You know, he just went home and just stared at the ground.
He didn't look at no feet.
He just went home and stared at the ground.
Oh, man. All right, so we're going to wrap this one up. I got a dope line for the week. It's my man DMX weighing in. Mike Geronimo's usual suspects. He starts off the song and says, what's all the noise about? Have some respect. Shut the F up. Shout out to D-Wave going to David Stern.
That's right.
Oh, man, we'll get into that more next week as that continues to develop. I don't think we're going to have a season, though, fellas.
Oh, no, we're not.
Yeah.
But the players don't care.
But, yeah, they're going to get money. Get money, stop hating.
That's right.
What it boils down to right now. Everybody's getting paid. So, Renegade Radio, RSG, Real Sports Guy, signing off until next Tuesday, 8:30 to 10:30. Peace. All right, fellas, we off air. Well, we on air, but we off air. We off live. We still recording.
we got in the after joint. But
yeah,
we got to talk about that NBA talk. You know, players save their money. They're ready for the long haul on this one, which I'm happy for.
I think the players are being grossly misrepresented by a lot of folks out there in the national media.
David Stern is pretty much showing his true colors. You know.
Yeah, I mean, he works for the owners.
He's a puppet. He can't help it.
I don't think he has much choice in the matter. As much as he realizes that this is not going to go well and this is not good for the – because he knows it's not good for the game. If anybody understands the perception of the league, it's David Stern. I mean, that's why he instilled the dress code. You know, that's why he's done a lot of the stuff that he's done, is because he gets that people view this league much differently than they view other leagues, and he has to try and counterbalance that with his legislative pen. But he worked for the owners in the end. That's who he works for, and that's who we got to dance for. But I was D-Wade got some respect back from me by putting him in his place and just saying, look, I'm a grown man. I'm a grown-ass man. You don't talk to me like that. I can appreciate that.
Like, what exactly happened there? I mean, I heard the original story that he stormed out, but has there been more information?
What I've read is that they were kind of going back and forth, talking about the specific issue they were talking about hasn't been disclosed. But David Stern kind of started to wag his finger at D-Wade, and D-Wade kind of gave him a grown-ass man speech that, look, man, nah. Who are you wagging your finger at? You know? And so at that moment, the players felt extremely disrespected, and the contingent of star players that showed up that consisted of Paul Pierce, Elton Brand, Carmelo, LeBron, D-Wade, they all were prepared to walk out, but Billy Hunter talked them in. They took a break. Actually, what happened was after D-Wade and Stern got into it, they took a break. They called a recess, and the players were just going to leave and not come back to the talks. But Billy Hunter talked them into going back into the room and continuing to talk. But it seems like the sides are so far apart right now that there just ain't going to be a season.
The funny thing about the NBA is that without a contract, these guys could play without an owner. It's not quite like football, not even like baseball, where you have, you know, spring training and camps and all the logistics and everything else. It's not that hard to put 15 guys on an airplane and shoot out to L.A. and play a ball game. And I'm waiting for the guys in the NBA just to go, look, we can do this ourselves. You want to be honest about it. If you're not going to negotiate a contract with us, if you're not going to, you know, send me my check, we can do this ourselves. We don't need nothing but a hoop and some nets. We can do this. You know? There's at least 32 businessmen in America right now that could pony up enough money to put this league right back together and call it something else and have the same kind of firepower and have the same kind of ability to run this. It's not like football where you have, you know, multiple coaches and you know, you have all that equipment that you have to figure out and all this stuff. You know, all you got to do is buy some plane tickets, grab some sneakers, snatch a ball up, and you can fill a gym up anywhere you want to go. And I'm surprised that some of these more entrepreneurial players aren't just saying that. Either you negotiate with us, or we'll just start our own league. We have the star power. We can do this.
Right. Ain't nobody showing up to watch no owners.
You know, it's not like football where the owners – have the team, you know, the NBA could literally, the players that are right there right now could say, you know, we can pony up enough money, we can hire a management team, we can run these arenas. You know, what function do you really serve to take the kind of money away from us that you want? Because, you know, I'm the one out there running up and down the court getting bad knees, not you.
Right.
So what are you really bringing to the table? What is it really all about?
Yeah, it's that point where you say, what infrastructure are you providing that I can't provide myself? You know, and that's a question that needs to be asked. But it's getting ugly. It's getting ugly. And it's not going to get any prettier.
Well, but everybody expected that. Everybody expected we missed at least half the season. So, and Billy Hunter prepared them for that. So they're all prepared for half a season at least. And the other thing about these players, they can go earn enough income other places that are going to hold them over.
So
they'll all begin to make these decisions over the next couple of weeks. And, you know, just the way the season's set up is lost. I mean, folks are going to start making plans here over the next couple of weeks, and you're going to hear more and more players coming out. They've signed some deals with some places, you know, because if you can get a million here, a million there, you're going to do it. It's not the whole job for the year. You know, even with all the other expenses they have accrued in their lifetime and lifestyle, they base and savings. But if they could add a little bit of that with some other stuff. And with some of these deals, you know, they can leverage percentage of gate. They can leverage percentage of advertising. They could leverage them.
But that's what Kobe's doing.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
Kobe's talking about revenue sharing in his contract. I'm like, is he buying ownership of the team? I mean, hell,
right.
I'd negotiate that in my contract if I was Kobe. I want a small percentage of the team.
That's right. Yeah. So, that's back to Ray's point. These are much more agile professionals than these other sports. And that's why I say the difference is that they're all in separate entities. They are literally independent brands. And even the lower level players have brand potential proportionally at their own level to do what they need. So, you know, it's going to be a standoff until somebody starts to make some things happen. So, yeah, we got to get into this one. We have to get into this.
Yeah, so get up to speed on what's going on, and we'll touch base on this one hard next week. But otherwise, fellas, I'm finna hit the hay. Got a long day tomorrow. Had a long day today. Got another long day after that. So, brother, gotta get his sleep, man. It was a good show though, and I'll be hitting y'all back with another rundown, and you know we'll be texting in between. So, I get at you, fellas. Y'all take care.
All right,
take care.
All right, man. Peace.
Peace.